Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Tomorrow, voters in Afghanistan head to the polls to decide whether Hamid Karzai deserves another term as president. To get a preview of the election, we made a connection earlier today with the BBC's Lise Doucet in Kabul.
Hello, it's Lise Doucet. Sorry, we've got the jammers.
She told us that noise was from jammers on the vehicles of the International Security Assistance Force. They had just left a BBC interview, and they used these jammers to block remote-controlled bombs. Well, security is the big concern in this election, so I asked Lise whether people in Kabul are anxious.
Anxious indeed, deeply anxious, particularly here in the Afghan capital, Kabul. We had at least three attacks on the city yesterday, including a rocket that landed in the presidential compound. I was walking just across the street close to the presidential compound when the rocket went over. You could hear the loud whoosh as it sailed past. And there was also a major car bomb just on the outskirts of Kabul, to the east of Kabul yesterday. More violence again this morning, a gun battle. And of course, that's just the capital. There's also been violence, particularly in provinces to the south. Now, today is also Afghan Independence Day, so the streets of Kabul are strangely quiet. Usually you'd expect a lot of people to be out with their families, but a lot of people are staying inside, just preparing, and I think making a decision about whether or not they feel it will be safe enough to vote tomorrow.
Right. Now, all of this is really the Taliban making good on its threat to punish people who vote to disrupt these elections. Do you think that people are going to say it's worth the risk to vote tomorrow?
We should never underestimate Afghans. I remember in the 2004 and 2005 elections here, there were also threats from the Taliban. There was alleged intimidation by warlords. And yet Afghans came out in large numbers to vote. In 2004, which was the first presidential poll after the fall of the Taliban, nearly 80% of Afghans voted. But the mood is completely different now, and Afghans have to make a decision as to whether or not it's worth it to cast their ballot. Just listen to some of the views we heard on the streets of Kabul.
I want security for the future of Afghanistan. Without security, we cannot have any other thing.
There are general worries of security. Explosions and attacks are everywhere. I am a shopkeeper. It has affected my mood as well. I am worried. Even if I send my son to open the shop, or even if I open it myself.
In this election, we would like to choose a person, to be honest, he can solve our problems. Now, right now, it's clear for all the world that the situation is getting worse day by day in Afghanistan. Yes, security, which is the main issue and main problem. And we want to choose someone who can solve all the problem of Afghanistan. And he can negotiate with the Taliban.
Besides security, Lise, what are people talking about? Why is it worth the risk to vote in these elections? What do they want from their government?
Despite the anxiety about the polls, I should also say that the Afghans I've been meeting also have a sense of anticipation. They know that this is meant to be one of the key building blocks to move their country closer to democracy. They know it's not going to be a perfect exercise, but they know they need a bit more practice in order to do it. I met one Afghan businessman in Kabul and I said, "Do you think there's going to be fraud in the elections?" He goes, "Yes," with an exclamation. And I said, "Well, do you think it's worthwhile having the polls?" And with equal fervor, he said, "Yes, we need these elections." He said, "Next year, the elections will be even better." And of course, there are parliamentary elections next year. Because of course, Afghans want their kids to go to school. They want better roads. I've just come back from Bamiyan province in the Central Highlands, a very peaceful place. Everybody talks about roads there. The potato farmers can't get their crops to market. Even the local musicians who talk about the Buddhas destroyed by the Taliban, they also talk about the dust on the road. So they have a lot to hope for here, and they're hoping that the elections can make a difference.
While fraud might be expected in this election, and we also heard reporting from your BBC colleagues recently that thousands of voting cards are being offered for sale, and there are also lots of bribes being offered. How can this possibly be a fair election?
Well, that's the question being asked by a lot of Afghans. And we put that question certainly to the Independent Election Commission. This is the first election since 2001 that are run primarily by Afghans, I believe, with international support. And a spokesperson for the Independent Election Commission says, yes, we've heard these reports of vote buying, but we're absolutely sure that we have the mechanisms in place to find out if people try to vote more than once. They are, of course, using the indelible ink. And so they assured us that they believe that Afghans will vote only once tomorrow. And of course, that is one of the basic principles of democracy. The big question is, of course, that at each polling station, and there are thousands of polling stations, the voting will be only as good as the polling officer there. And can young polling officers resist the pressures of, say, the local commander or the tribal leader who comes in with a stack of proxy votes and basically throws them down on the desk and say, I'm voting for 40 people? These are the pressures. There's going to be the pressures there, but what the hope is that there will be, over the whole country, there'll be enough of clear and fair voting in order for this to be a legitimate result.
There are dozens of candidates as well, but current President Hamid Karzai is the front runner. Is it widely assumed that he will be reelected?
I think there is a general feeling that eventually he will win this contest. The big question is, will he do it in the first round? Will he get more than 50%? Or will it go to a second round? And the polls, insofar as the polls are reliable here, have wavered slightly. President Karzai has had sort of around 40 to 45%. It goes up and down. But his main challenger, the former foreign minister, Abdullah Abdullah, is the one that has been making big strides. And he could possibly deny Hamid Karzai a victory in the first round. Then it would go to the second. And I think if it was a two-horse race between Dr. Abdullah and Hamid Karzai, Hamid Karzai would probably win, because Dr. Abdullah, despite the fact that his father is from the Pashtun areas in the south, he's largely identified with the northern areas, particularly with Panjshir, which is a very powerful region that has produced a lot of this country's powerful figures.
Earlier this week, the notorious warlord, General Abdul Rashid Dostum, flew in to endorse Hamid Karzai. What does this suggest, do you think?
Well, it's more proof, if proof was needed, of the deals that President Karzai has been making. It's widely believed that General Dostum, who's been living for some time in exile in Turkey and is wanted by some organizations for alleged war crimes, has come back because there are a number of leaders of his community, the ethnic Uzbeks, who basically told Hamid Karzai, you won't get our vote and the votes of all the people who back us unless General Dostum is allowed to come. And so, true to form, General Dostum came just before the elections and he gave his ringing support for President Karzai. And this is causing concern here because he's not the only controversial figure that Hamid Karzai has made votes for. So if indeed Hamid Karzai wins, what kind of an election or what kind of a result is going to emerge from this election? Is it going to be a coalition of the warlords? That it has to be said, a great number of Afghans blame not just for the destruction of Kabul, but some of the negative things that have happened in this country in recent decades.
And what does Mr. Karzai say about his alliances with warlords like General Dostum?
If you want a way to describe Hamid Karzai's philosophy, we often call it the big tent approach. He's come under a lot of pressure since 2001 to basically sideline these controversial warlords, to try to develop a new leadership, a young leadership, a more democratic leadership. But he always says, well, these are people I knew during the jihad against the Soviet Union. They should also have a chance to be part of this government. He's believed that he could bring everyone into the tent. But I think a lot of people are now saying these people are not going to change their ways, and they certainly are casting a dark shadow over this country's ability to move on into a more democratic and prosperous future.
What about some of the other candidates who may be long shots, Lise, but the women candidates, for example? How are they doing in all of this and campaigning in this election?
There are two women candidates. There is no prospect that they will actually win in this election, but I think it's important symbolically. I spoke to one of the candidates just a few days ago, Shala Atta. She says she wants to change the policies of the government. She doesn't agree with the way Hamid Karzai has been running Afghanistan, and I think they increased their public profile. And I just actually came away from talking to Masuda Jalal. She ran in the 2004 presidential elections. After the election, which of course she didn't win, she became the Women's Affairs Ministry. So aside from anything else, and it's not just the women candidates, a lot of people have running in these polls because they simply want to raise their profile, and hopefully they'll find a niche for themselves afterwards to play a more active role in this country's government.
I've read some staggering statistics, a 40% unemployment rate in Afghanistan, 35% of Afghanis are malnourished. I'm wondering, with that kind of a backdrop to things, what do people really expect from this election, and what about young people? Are they excited about this election, or are they concerned about the possibility of corruption? corruption and the fairness issues and obviously the economic issues that they're living with.
So many young people I have spoken to in the recent weeks as I traveled across the country are enthusiastic about these elections. It's very touching. They're the new generation. They want to make this work. They don't want to return to the harsh rule of the Taliban. You particularly see this among young Afghan women journalists. They simply are thriving in the little amount of liberty that they've been given. And I think if there's one bright spark in this election, it's the way the Afghan media have tried to be as impartial as possible, even though some of the television stations are owned by big businessmen or commanders who obviously are backing certain candidates, but there's been vibrant election coverage, balanced insofar as you can be balanced with nearly 40 candidates and some 3,000 candidates for the provincial elections. And I think, you know, and today we had a call from the government for foreign and Afghan media not to report on any incidents of violence in Election Day. And there was an immediate response from the head of the Afghan Journalists Association saying that call doesn't fit in with democratic principles. And I should mention in response to the first part of your question that, yes, Afghanistan is very poor. Yes, it's one of the poorest countries in the world. This is a country with, outside of Kabul, hardly no electricity. I was in Bamiyan province where only a few kilometers of road, a few miles of road, are actually paved, but they know that a successful election is another stepping stone for them to improve their country. It's going to take a long time. It could take a generation, but they have to keep moving forward and not back.
You mentioned the request on the part of the government to journalists not to report on any violence tomorrow, and it's my understanding that today reporters who did try to report on an attack in Kabul were beaten back by police, were threatened. Are you going to report on violence, and are you concerned about how tensions might really, rise to something violent because of that refusal to obey?
Well, we're in Afghanistan because we want to report on these elections. We want to see them with our own eyes. And so I'm sure I can speak for all of the journalists here, whether Afghan or foreign. We're here to report on the elections. It's an important part of the process. And I know that some journalists have got into difficulty. It seems to depend on certain polling stations. Some parts of the government are taking a harder line than others. There certainly have been very strict rules handed down to the security forces about what journalists can do or not do at individual polling stations. So it may be a rather mixed picture, if you like, on election day, but I know journalists will be out there trying as much as possible to do the best job they can under difficult circumstances.
Just one more question. If many young people do not want to see the country go back to Taliban rule, and I read recently that about 70% of the people currently involved in the fighting on the part of the Taliban really are there only because it's a way for them to get paid in Afghanistan, what does this say about the strength of the Taliban here that this voting is even going forward?
There's no denying that the Taliban have made a comeback, and yet most of the main presidential candidates here, if there was one issue if they agreed on, they said after the elections, we have to talk to the Taliban. There is no military solution to this conflict, and therefore we have to find a way to deal with the Taliban, whether it's at local level, district by district, with individual commanders who, as you say, may simply be doing it because it's a way to feed their family, to find a peace, if you like, in their district. Or they could even be talks at the higher level, the more ideological level, what some of the officials in the Obama administration have been calling the reconcilables or the irreconcilables. I saw the former Taliban foreign minister, Wakil Ahmed Muntawakil, today, and he says there is only one Taliban. He believed that actually there could be talks right up and down the chain from the lower level Taliban fighters right up to the top. But I think that is going to be the big question after these elections. But first, let's see how free, fair, and safe those elections are.
That's the BBC's Lise Doucette in Kabul. Lise, thanks for speaking with us and stay safe.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. According to the Library and Book Trade Almanac, more than 24 million medical books were sold in 2008. For many doctors trained in the intricacies of science, writing a book for a mass audience doesn't come easily, but that is not stopping them. In Boston, nearly 200 medical professionals recently gathered for a 3-day course on publishing, including what was called a shameless pitches session. Doctors had to get up in front of nearly 200 peers and a panel of literary agents to pitch book proposals in just a minute and a half. Here and Now's Jill Ryan has her story.
On your mark, get set, go.
I'm Sam Forman, physician, businessman, adjunct, Harvard
faculty member, and local historian.
90 seconds is not a lot of time when you're trying to woo literary agents into offering you a book deal. Dr. Sam Forman learned that the hard way when he took the podium to pitch his book on an American Revolutionary War physician.
Readers of bestsellers such as McCullough's 1776 and John Adams.
I always tell people, if you can't summarize your book idea in one sentence, then you really don't have a book.
That's Dr. Julie Silver. She's running the session. She says, to be successful, be succinct. For her, 90 seconds is generous. And that has worry practically etched on the faces of the handful of medical professionals nervously clutching notes as they wait their turns. Psychologist Allison Caruso was running over a few last pointers as she prepared to pitch a book about supporting her boyfriend who struggled through cancer.
So not to say a lot and to really try to be direct and articulate, but then I want to be clear about why we need this book out there in the sea of so many other books.
For some, standing out in that sea wasn't difficult.
My name is James Greenblatt. The name of my book is Malnourished Minds, Anorexia Nervosa Redefined.
Dr. Greenblatt treats patients with eating disorders, and his theory is that anorexia isn't a symptom of emotional problems or cultural values. He blames malnutrition.
The starved brain, without essential nutrients, particularly the minerals zinc and the essential fatty acids, create all the symptoms of anorexia nervosa.
Professionals and parents who may not have a science background are Dr. Greenblatt's intended audience, but he's finding writing for them difficult.
I've been so fascinated with the role of some of these nutrients in brain function, particularly zinc, that my interest is on a very technical level of how it affects certain neurons in the brain that control appetite, and trying to simplify that for the consumer has been challenging.
But boiling down complex information doesn't necessarily sell books, so some turn to theatrics.
Oh, my goodness, where am I? Where have I landed?
One woman wore a shiny yellow gown and tiara to accent her pitch for a children's book. And aspiring author Giselle Gantz pretended to be a ladybug looking for adventure.
Oh my, where am I and where is this adventure taking me?
But why are these doctors wannabe authors? Neuropsychologist Karen Postel says she writes because she finds herself repeating the same shtick to her patients.
And I'd love to be able to say to them, hey, you know, it's all in here in this book. Would you like to read this book?
For others, book pitches are more personal. Take pediatrician Susan Cohen Kenny. The room fell silent with her presentation.
6 years ago, my 42-year-old healthy husband dropped dead, leaving me alone with our three traumatized children, twin 5-year-old girls and an 8-year-old boy who has since been diagnosed with high-functioning autism. That would have been quite enough, thank you.
But there was more. Cohen Kenny soon learned she had a high risk of having breast cancer. She decided to have a double mastectomy and learned there had been cancer in the tissue. The ordeal left her wanting to dole out advice.
I wanted to write a book of my experiences because I found that there was not a support manual available for how to talk to my kids when I was ambushed with breast cancer.
Many doctors were pitching part memoir, part self-help books. There was the woman who struggled with urinary incontinence, another who overcame poverty to complete medical school. Even one of the judges had a book on surviving cancer.
I wrote a memoir about having cancer that came out 10 years ago. And at that time, there weren't as many. And now that field is so flooded. You have to be an extraordinary writer at this point, or you have to have a gimmick. There was a book that came out last year called Crazy Sexy Cancer. Unfortunately, so many people are getting it. And when people go through a crisis like that, they always think, I need to write about this. And they probably do. It's just hard to get their books out when there's that many.
But these doctors will still try. During a break in the presentations, they lined up for a chance to speak one-on-one with literary agents.
I'm trying to do is to get an agent to get a book published Is it a policy book? Is it a book kind of history?
It's a little bit of all of medical history, policy.
Session leader Dr. Julie Silver says within a year, about two-thirds of the professionals here will publish, most in a magazine or online. And some may get that elusive book deal. That's still a goal for anorexia expert Dr. James Greenblatt, even though he doesn't think his pitch went particularly well.
I didn't end up saying anything that I had prepared on the papers, and I forgot the title until the end, but the feedback was quite positive, with a number of publishers asking for the proposal, so that was pretty exciting.
Turns out Dr. Greenblatt's pitch was pretty convincing. He told me that soon after the course, he ended up signing a book deal. Look for his Malnourished Minds in bookstores October 2010.
That's Here and Now's Jill Ryan. Tomorrow on Here and Now, a national bus tour to rally opposition to the president's health care reform plan. And we'll talk with a Democratic congressman who has no insurance, even though he has access to great federal health benefits. That's tomorrow, back after the news, Here and Now. When was the last time you sat in complete silence? No radio, no iPod, no conversation. Well, author Anne LeClaire spends the first and third Monday of each month in silence, something she's been doing for more than 16 years. While she says she would break silence in the case of an emergency, she does maintain complete silence even when those Mondays fall on special occasions like birthdays or anniversaries. Her new memoir is titled Listening Below the Noise, a meditation on the practice of silence. And she joins us from WCAI on Cape Cod. Anne, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, what are the rules that you impose on yourself to stay silent the first and third Mondays of every month?
Well, the number one rule, and the one that I started with, was just don't talk. And then as the years went by, I stopped watching TV, stopped listening to music, and then even the text messaging and email and all, I just wanted to back off from it all.
And how do your family members react to this decision of yours to be silent on these days of the month?
I guess it would depend on when you ask them. When I began, my husband did not like this at all. He found it inconvenient. We have a busy life. He wanted to ask me things. But about the fifth year, the Sunday night before a silent day, he said, you know, I didn't used to like your silent days, but they taught me something I really needed to learn. Most things aren't that important. And that's a lesson I learned, too. I mean, we live in a time of such, I call it a false urgency, that we think everything is important, and it's not.
You now lead workshops on silence and the practice of silence, but I bet a lot of people have trouble with this idea of being silent. What kind of advice do you give to them?
We've become so used to everywhere we go there being levels of noise. I had to fly from Logan Airport into Chicago one day, and in a coffee bar, there were three flat-screen TVs attached to the wall, all turned to a different station. So many of our public spaces have this kind of constant barrage of noise that it can feel odd to be in silence. And then again, there's that fear that somehow by falling silent, we'll be invisible, we'll be isolated. But what I found, in fact, the great paradox for me was it was through silence that I became most profoundly connected to myself and to my family and to my friends and to my work.
Are there things that you suggest people do to maybe take baby steps toward getting to extended periods of time being silent?
You know, there are lots of things we can do. One is when we get in the car, we don't necessarily have to just switch on the radio. I know it's probably not the best advice to give, particularly
right
at this moment, but it's fun to explore that.
Don't tell people to turn off the radio, Anne.
The other thing is to wake up, say, a half an hour or an hour early in the day and just start the day in silence, going for a walk without an earbud stuck in your ear, or doing dishes, or hanging clothes, or ironing clothes. Kind of exploring the things we used to do in silence that technology has changed and made noisier.
Is there a particular story of a person, aside from yourself, who you think has learned this lesson about the importance of silence that you could share with us?
Two, actually. One was a woman that read the book and said she wanted to then experience silence, and for the first time since May 2001, she felt at peace, and that was when her son had committed suicide. Another woman came to an event I did and decided that she would practice silence on Mondays to give speech up for Lent. And it's an older couple, and she did it, and at the end of the first day, she asked her husband how it was, and he said, I found it really hard. You know, I didn't really like it, and I found it hard. But then I thought, you know, this is a good thing, because eventually one of us will be left alone, and we better get used to silence. And both of those stories touched me tremendously.
Author Anne LeClaire spends the first and third Monday of each month in silence. She's been doing this for more than 16 years. Her new memoir is titled Listening Below the Noise, a meditation on the practice of silence. Anne, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Deborah. And are you going to try silence?
I don't know. I think it would be a real job hazard if I couldn't talk. So, Anne, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Deborah.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any of our stories. You can go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us, or you can send an email to letters@hereandnow.org. We'll be back after a quick break with What Do Older Americans Want from Healthcare Reform? It's Here and Now. The latest polls on healthcare reform show that in the past month, Americans have become more anxious about their healthcare, especially senior citizens. And some say winning over seniors, who account for about 40% of all voters, is a huge hurdle facing healthcare reform. With us is Nancy Lamond of the AARP, the advocacy group for Americans 50 and older, and her group has 40 million members. Nancy, why are seniors so anxious?
My sense of what's happened is that as the public debate has been very sensationalized in the last few weeks with talks of government takeover and death panels, that people have just naturally gotten very anxious. And so I think as the debate becomes richer on some of the specifics and as it gets away from screaming and accusations, you're going to find that a number of poll numbers will change.
CBS News is reporting this week that about 60,000 of your members have quit since July 1st because they're angry about your position, your role in this healthcare debate. And on YouTube, there's a clip of an AARP town meeting that was held in Dallas this month. Do you know what I'm referring to?
I do.
And members at that meeting got upset because they said the AARP was endorsing the president's health care reform plan, which we should say President Obama initially said, and then you clarified and said, no, we have not endorsed any plan at this point. But at this meeting, the AARP representative ended up leaving in a huff and pulling the plug on the microphone. And we have a clip from the meeting I'd like to listen to.
AARP has not endorsed the legislation. You're incorrect. Anyway, I'm done.
Ladies and gentlemen, just remember, this is our republic, this is our government. It's up to us to maintain it.
What do you make of that, and what do you make of that report that 60,000 of your members have left in the past 6 weeks or so?
We consider every member important to us, and we are disappointed if anyone leaves AARP. But also since July 1st, we've increased our membership. Since July 1st, it's running 30-1 in terms of new members versus members who've left AARP. But the point is that's important is that this is a serious debate, and it's an emotional one. And the clip you ran, while we thought it was unfortunate to have ended the meeting that way after it got out of control, we did three more forums in Texas that week, and we've done hundreds around the country.
What would you say to try to make sure that all of your members are represented in this debate?
Well, as you know, half of our members are over the age of 65 and have Medicare, and the other half, 50 to 64, are in the private insurance market. And so we are engaged in effect, in both parts of the healthcare debate.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think needs to be done to fix the system?
Well, in terms of Medicare, we want to see Medicare improved and strengthened. As you know, virtually every senior has one or two prescription drugs, and they are going up in cost every single day. The second thing we want to see is to ensure that Medicare pays doctors fairly. And finally, really go after that waste in the system to ensure the long-term financial security of Medicare.
How do you improve and strengthen Medicare and ensure its long-term security and rein in costs at the same time?
There is an awful lot of waste in the system. If we can kind of squeeze that out, we can pay for a few of these improvements in the program.
There are myths that you say that you've been working on to try to dispel in this healthcare debate. What's the main one, would you say?
I think one that concerns our members a great deal is that healthcare decisions are going to be taken away from you and the doctors. There is nothing in any of the legislation being discussed that we believe puts anyone between you and your doctor. The other myth is that any kind of healthcare reform is going to increase costs and cut benefits for those who are on Medicare. We have maintained that certainly we will not support, nor have we seen in any of the legislation moving through the Congress, provisions that would cut seniors' benefits.
But I believe it was $500 billion in Medicare savings that was within a particular plan. Savings, maybe not necessarily cuts, but obviously raises a question about whether those savings will be realized through cuts.
Sure. Well, we've looked at all of the proposals that have been put forward and believe that the majority of those savings are going to come from reducing waste, fraud, and abuse.
Yeah, we've heard this before, that reining in waste and fraud in Medicare will be able to save an awful lot of money. But Medicare is what, $37 trillion in debt?
Well, there have been studies that show that reining in waste, fraud, and abuse will save a substantial amount of money. We know that that there are, as you just go through the healthcare system and you fill out multiple forms and you end up with extra tests, we just know that that number has to be enormous.
There's been a little bit of debate about whether your organization does endorse a healthcare overhaul plan or not. And you've said you've certainly mentioned some of the concerns that you have about the legislation that's been put forward thus far. Have you endorsed a plan yet?
We have not endorsed a healthcare plan.
Mm-hmm. And is there a particular piece or provision that is almost a make or break it for you, that you could not support a healthcare overhaul plan unless it included X? What would X be?
Well, we could not support a healthcare plan that cut benefits for Medicare recipients.
All right. Well, Nancy Lamond, Executive Vice President for Social Impact for the AARP, the Advocacy Group for Americans 50 and Older, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
And this update now on the political wrangling over health care reform, which is continuing on Capitol Hill. Some lawmakers are now asking for detailed financial records from dozens of the nation's largest insurance firms. The insurers have not commented on whether they'll honor the request for their records on things such as compensation for executives, premiums paid by policyholders, and administrative expenses and profits. A spokesman for Michigan Congressman Bart Stupak says letters requesting this information were sent to 52 health insurers with $2 billion or more in annual premiums. The letter asks for the information by early next month. The requests come as President Obama's health care proposal is under attack from several critics, and much of the opposition focuses on proposals for the government to offer insurance that would compete with private carriers. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. Here and Now listeners may remember this voice. That's Hao Jiangtian, the first Chinese singer of Western opera to make it big on the great opera stages of Europe and the United States. Renowned tenor Placido Domingo wasn't kidding when he noted that Tian's life is worthy of an opera. Tian's parents were staunch revolutionaries who loved Western music, but he grew up during the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s when all things Western were forbidden. After his parents were exiled from Beijing, the teenage Tian led a hardscrabble life alone and working in a Beijing boiler factory. But he went from there to the stage of the Metropolitan Opera in New York, where he made his debut during the 1991 season. Tian is now working on a one-man show about his life based on his book, Along the Roaring River, My Wild Ride from Mao to the Met. I spoke with him last September when his memoir first came out, and he was appearing in the San Francisco opera production of The Bonesetter's Daughter, based on the Amy Tan novel.
Without fear, they'll be casting to the worst place, where the poor, the fools, and the foreigners live.
A New York Times reviewer said Tian stole every scene he was in, and I asked him how the wild ride of his life informed his singing.
Well, I think I always believe in experience for artists. My parents were sent away in 1969. I was only 13 years old, so I was home alone in Beijing, so I went wild and I started working in the factory for 6-7 years in the factory. And then I started, you know, my voice training. So I think what I saw, what I experienced, what I heard, and, you know, my family experience all, you know, helped, you know, my opera career step by step. And also, you know, as opera singer on stage, you have to, you know, let people feel what's deepest feeling in your heart. I think that's very, very important. For example, I arrived in New York City in 1983, December 16th. And I had never seen an opera. And the next day, actually, I only had $50 in my pocket. And I spent $8. I bought a standing pass. I went to the Metropolitan Opera.
And an older couple gave you their tickets, but you didn't understand why, because you couldn't speak English. Their tickets were where?
The tickets were for the middle of a fifth row, actually the best, most expensive tickets. Pavarotti was just in front of my face. So that was my first live opera experience, actually.
And then 10 years later, to the day, you are on stage with Pavarotti at the Met. You had a small part, and you tried to tell him how he inspired you. What happened?
So he kept saying, "Si, si, bravo, bravo." And then went into his dressing room and closed the door in front of my face. So I thought probably I did something wrong.
And then he did something during the curtain call, which surprised you. He waved everyone else on stage for their bows, and then what did he do?
And he waited until my turn, and he grabbed my hand and went out with me together.
Oh.
And he repeated that for the rest 7 performances.
Oh. Wow, well, that was an amazing story. So you know, let's talk about, though, how you got to New York in 1983, which is, it's a big jump from this 14-year-old boy who was working in a factory in Beijing with no parents when you were completely wild, and
yes,
when you obviously had these sort of romantic ideas about life that certainly weren't condoned during the Cultural Revolution. How do you go from there to 1983, landing in New York and spending $8 of your $35 on a ticket to the Metropolitan Opera?
That was a long march, actually. I found my voice, yes, just by accident. And that was 1975, the last year of a Cultural Revolution. And we didn't know what we would, what was the future of the country. You know, nobody knew. And one day I was on my bike to look for a friend. I didn't want to climb up to a fifth floor, so I was just shouting, you know, outside of the building, "Hey, are you home? Could you hear me?" So my friend was not home, and another window opened. A gentleman actually showed up at the window and started talking to me, and he told me, "Well, you should find a voice teacher, and you may have a singing career." So actually, that 5 minutes changed my life. I found a teacher. I joined the first public audition for the Central Conservatory, and the competition was very keen because over 500 young singers joined the audition, and I was the lucky one.
Wow. Wow. You know, it can't be easy being a Chinese-based singing Western opera. There's right. all kinds of different things. Can you talk about that a little bit, about how you overcame some of those difficulties?
Well, the only thing is you have to keep fighting, trying, pushing yourself, because this is different, totally different culture for a Chinese singer. Also, you know, for basses, the most important roles in operas are tenor and sopranos, you know. Mm. And as a bass, and we are always either a devil or, you know, crazy guy and something. Anyway, just don't give up. Yeah. Don't give up.
Gold, more fragrant, fragrant gold.
And now, as we said, you're in The Bonesetter's Daughter. That's the new opera based on the Amy Tan novel. And, you know, it must be quite a big difference now to look around and see that you've got this opera, you've got Chinese-born opera singers now on stage. What does that feel like now?
Well, the role I'm playing is a Mr. Chan. It's a most evil character I have ever portrayed on stage. Bad guy. But, you know, probably because of my experience, I feel I could understand this bad guy. I could go deep in his heart to feel him. And I would do a good evil... I would be a good evil guy.
Well, best of luck to you, and thanks very much for speaking with
Thank
us.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
I spoke with Hao Jiangtian last September about his memoir, Along the Roaring River, My Wild Ride from Mao to the Met. He's now preparing a one-man show about his life. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.